All right, everyone, welcome back to Dialogue Not Division. It's been quite the last 2 weeks. I did take last week off for spring break, spent a little time relaxing with the kids, and man, did a lot of things happen while I was away over the last 2 weeks. There's just been so many things. We'll cover just a few of the things that are on my mind today. The big things I wanted to cover were, of course, the two mass shootings that just happened. That's been in the news everywhere, and a lot of the political topics and fallout over that. I also wanted to cover just a little bit about the immigration issues at the border, particularly just kind of how I feel about the situation, what's going on there. And then what I really want to get into, the heart of this episode, is I really want to cover fact checkers. What I've noticed and what I alluded to earlier in these episodes is fact checkers are very interesting. I often saw them fact-checking things in ways I thought might be biased or maybe dishonest, and I wanted to go through and look at some of that and kind of check to see how I felt and bring some evidence into that discussion. So I'm very much looking forward to presenting what I found here. It's quite great. But before I get into that, I did, as I mentioned, wanted to talk about the two mass shootings. So by now, most of you probably know that there were two terrible mass shootings that happened, one in Atlanta and another one in Boulder, Colorado. The one in Atlanta was, I believe, eight people were killed. I think nine people shot, eight people killed. It was some, well, I'd say mentally unstable. That goes without saying when it comes to a mass shooting. Individual that shot up three massage parlors. It's a terrible, terrible thing. There's a lot of different narratives going back and forth with that one. A lot of people are tying it into, especially the media are tying it into the recent rise in anti-Asian violence and crime since these happened at massage parlors, and six out of the eight victims were Asian. That was about the first narrative that jumped right out. So that of course went on. There was a press briefing that was done by, I believe, a captain and the chief of police, where they were investigating if it was a hate crime. And of course, at this time, there isn't a lot of facts other than the facts of kind of what happened, who died, and what the shooter himself said, and a little bit of the investigation. The FBI are investigating it. What I found is that the media is already going with the narrative, or a lot of the media is going with the narrative of that this was a white supremacist doing this out of anti-Asian hate. There's a lot of pressure right now to try him as a hate crime because the victims were obviously, the vast majority of them were Asian, and he targeted these massage parlors that primarily had Asians in them. During the press briefings that came out, of course, people asked if this was going to be charged as a hate crime. And what the sheriff said was basically they were looking into all possibilities, but at this time, they didn't have that evidence talking with the individual. And the sheriff caught a lot of flack for saying that. Basically, what he relayed was the facts of the matter is the individual mentioned that he had a what he called as he was suffering from a sex addiction. The information we do know is the individual's claiming that he had a bad day. I'm going to put that in air quotes there, because that's in no way an excuse. One thing that's interesting is the individual that repeated those words, the words that the individual told them, basically there was a bunch of articles saying that he was excusing the behavior because the person had a bad day, or it was just because it was a bad day, not because of anti-Asian things. And he was specifically relaying what the individual in custody had said to him, and he wasn't trying to excuse that. So I wanted to From all that I found, I don't think that narrative is a good one. I believe the police captain that did that, it's not a great narrative. Again, he was just relaying what the individual said. So the facts that have come out now are that this individual was a very strict religious, had a very strict religious background, basically was blaming himself for having his sex addiction, and. What what the best we can tell is that these may have been massage parlors of ill repute, we'll put it that way. And it's possible, I don't think it's been confirmed yet, that this individual had been frequenting those. Evidently, he had quite a lot of issues. He had asked his roommate to take his laptop away. He was in, I guess, counseling for this. And he went out and bought a gun. And according to his own words, he was basically taking this out on the place that was causing temptation to him. So he was blaming the temptation for his inability to control himself. So it's a terrible thing, of course. Very, very terrible thing. At this time, it's hard to say if this was motivated by any specific anti-Asian things. A lot of people are still running with that narrative, basically, because what they're saying is it's objectification of Asian women, or in this case, that he really liked Asian women. I haven't seen any evidence of that just yet. More may come out where it's that. It might have just been the opportunities that he had locally were at those massage parlors, again, allegedly. And so he's taking it out again. He's blaming the temptation rather than himself or his inability to control himself. A lot of people are pushing this as, you know, religion's fault. Not a lot of people. Some people are pushing it as it's oppressive religion that caused this. I will say that's one of the things I almost called when it first came out, the sex addiction. My wife and I were talking about it. She's like, well, what does that have anything to do with it? And I said, well, if I had a guess, I would say he's from a very strict religious background, which turned out to be true. And it was likely feelings of guilt. And he blames what he saw as people enabling him. Obviously, that's not sane in any way, and that's not rational. It's not a good thing to do. It could also be that there's anti-Asian feelings there, or perhaps he's definitely glorifying women or objectifying women for sure. So that's a big issue, a society issue there that I would say is really at the root cause. A lot of people, of course, are bringing into this gun violence and calling for gun control as well. The shooter in this case, it actually took quite a bit of looking into, or surprising amount, not a lot, but of ability to look into it. He used a 9mm pistol that he bought that day and went over and did that, drove between the three different parlors. And that's what happened. So with that, a lot of people are calling for, of course, waiting periods and different things. Stricter gun control is coming from that. Of course, this is a terrible, terrible situation. It's a person that did something horrible. And then just a couple days later, we have another mass shooting, another terrible one, this one in Boulder, Colorado. This one was another individual that went and he killed, I believe, 10 people is the number here, including one police officer that was responding. In this case, it was quite easy to find the weapon they used, which I thought was interesting. We'll get into that a little bit, but he used an assault-style weapon. I'm going to put that in quotes because the assault weapon isn't really defined by any legal or really societal standard, but it is something I don't want to get too wrapped up and pedantics or with the definition of it. Most people know what we're talking about is an AR style rifle or an AK style rifle that he was talking about. So of course he used that, and he killed 10 people in this case. I also saw the white supremacist narrative coming out quite strongly on this one. I will say it when his name and image came out. He's definitely not the he's a Syrian immigrant that came here, and it seems like he had a lot of mental health issues as well. From best I can tell, he had some past cases of violence when he was in high school against other students there. He was paranoid, and he kind of, as well as he was, thought a lot of people were against him, and he felt like America was an oppressive place or racist place based off of some of the Facebook posts I've seen, and he took it out on individuals. I'm not sure why he chose a grocery store, or what the logic was there, but that is what happened. As with every tragedy that happens, no matter what happens, either side of the political spectrum decide to use it or try to use it to their political advantage, whichever one can. Of course, the left is calling for gun control because of these terrible, terrible acts of violence that were committed with guns. And at the time, the right is, of course, kind of trying to rein in some of the gun control. There already are a couple gun control legislation pieces working their way, I believe, through the House. quite strict ones, actually. And they're kind of using this as a way to push this. The waiting period portion likely would not have done anything for the second shooter. The second shooter, I think, bought his 6 days before. So depending on your waiting period, some have much longer. That wouldn't have helped a waiting period. It's unknown if a waiting period that many people are calling for would have helped with the first shooter because he did buy it the day of. It's hard to know if, you know, if a cool off period would have helped. Some people, of course, are saying that it would have because he said, again, he said he had that bad day. So some people are saying, you know, maybe if he had a better day, then it wouldn't have happened. Perhaps, but to me, a mentally unstable person like that, this doing that obviously has some issues, and I don't necessarily think just waiting out a couple days would have would fix those issues. Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have. It's impossible to know at this point. So with this, of course, it's the biggest thing that I noticed was the difference in the way these two stories are being handled by the media. I'm a big critic, for those that don't know, of mainstream media for many reasons. I actually find that a lot of people, I think I went over this in the past, but a lot of people on both sides of the aisle are a big critic of the media, and mostly because they don't necessarily feel like they're objective and they're not reporting as they should. Again, immediately when the first one happened, it came out with this anti-Asian, it was an anti-Asian, it was a hate crime, it was all of this before any of the evidence came. I'll give Joe Biden credit. He said, hey, I'm going to wait until the investigation is done, and then we'll make a determination, which is, again, what I would recommend everyone do, is let's get some of the facts and see what the motivation is behind this. Obviously, it disproportionately affected or drastically affected people from the Asian community. So it was a terrible act of violence on Asians. What's required for a hate crime currently to be charged as a hate crime is you do have to be able to show intent, and that intent, or it was because of one of those protected categories, such as in this case, them being an Asian. So if they can show that this was because they were Asian, or it was fueled directly because they're Asian, it would be tried as a hate crime. Again, I haven't seen any evidence yet, and I believe the latest news posting are that there's no direct evidence of that, and it would be very unlikely that they would be able to try that and get a conviction with that. So, of course, that's going out immediately. Motive was put to that one. And with the second shooter, there kind of was, again, right when it happened, before the name got out, all of that, it was talking about it being white supremacy, of course. And then it kind of turned out that he wasn't white, depending on how you define white. It really depends, again, because many of the stats I saw that talk about the different shooters, whether or not they're white or not, do actually include people of that descent. And again, the media now is saying, you know, is almost immediately when they found out, backed off of, like, we're not sure why, we're waiting on why, we're waiting on the narrative, we don't know why, we're not going to speculate. So I thought that was interesting. Again, the one is a more direct speculation, I'd say, with the first one than the second one. But I thought it was interesting that it was handled. And then I mentioned I had to dig a little while to find out what weapon was used, other than the fact that everywhere on media, it was that, you know, he bought the weapon right away. And this is something I find a lot in mass shootings, is if it wasn't an AR-style rifle, they don't list it, or they list it deep down in an article. This is one that I found from USA Today. I scrolled down, and you'll see down in the article, it talks about the wait time before purchase, and it does say he bought the 9mm handgun just hours before he went on the shooting spree. And then, of course, they talk about how a waiting thing may or may not have caused that. They talk about how there was no waiting period in that city, or that state, excuse me. There was no state. And then, of course, they bring up the unrelated fact, but similar act, that basically you have to make there's no waiting period for a handgun, but there's a 24-hour waiting period for an abortion so that you could change your mind, which they thought was hypocritical. Maybe tipping my hand a little bit before we have the abortion conversation, but I can absolutely see why you do that and why you'd mandate or want to mandate a 24-hour waiting period for such a life-altering decision for the baby. So again, I do consider babies in the womb a life, and to me, they're mandating a 24-hour waiting period before you kill a living being. So to me, those two don't directly equate. I'll save that conversation for a different day. That's one of the topics that I actually have a hard time seeing both sides on. But I'm sure one day we'll get there. And that might be my first guest on the show, is I'll have to bring somebody else in to have that discussion, perhaps to change my mind. However, I kind of doubt it. Some things are deeply seated in some people, and that's one of mine. I did mention at the start of this, I have some things that I have a hard time seeing both sides, and that's one of them. But anyway, so that of course was going on. And then you'll notice I searched for same exact terminology, weapon used by the Boulder shooter. And first page, this is actually the first result underneath the ads that I clipped out. You see that it says here that it happened. He had a handgun and a military-style semi-automatic rifle is right there when you search for it, and this was the first result. This is often the case. If a military-style rifle was used, is they don't hide that fact. However, if there's any other weapon or anything else, it seems like the news just doesn't cover it because they don't want to point out the fact that the majority, and we'll get into this a little bit, the majority of gun deaths and shooting deaths are actually by handgun, including mass shootings, depending on how you define mass shootings, are actually done by a handgun and not by an AR or assault rifle or military style rifle, however you want to say it. Again, I understand the terminology. I don't like to get caught up too much in the terminology. I think that's a crutch a lot of conservatives use, is, you know, calling people out on bad uses of terminology instead of actually debating them on the argument. So I don't want to get too much into that because we all know what we mean when we say an AR style rifle. So with that, again, I thought that was interesting how they handled those two different things, how they kind of bury one thing. One of the pro-gun people that I follow brought up an interesting thing. Of course, on maybe a lighter note, not really, it's actually pretty sad. Another thing that hit the news was that President Biden, he tripped a couple times going up the stairs at Air Force One, or slipped one of the times going pretty much all the way to the ground. And the one YouTuber related that to, hey, you want to ban all ARs? Well, there's actually more stair deaths than there are AR deaths every year. So here we found one source. I think he found a different one that was actually a little bit lower, but it's approximately 1,600 people die annually from falling down the stairs. The point there was not necessarily that those two are a direct equivalent. Obviously, one's an act of violence on another, where another is an accident, two different things. But a lot of times what I see is there's a lot of fear-mongering around specifically these AR rifles, the military-style rifles, again, whatever you want to call them. There's a lot of fear-mongering around that. There's a really, really a lot of the media pushes this fear around it. And of course, when these mass shootings happen and they do have an AR-style rifle or, again, a military-style rifle, they really amplify that and talk about how deadly they are and many other things. So I wanted to dig a little bit into some of those more facts. I'll remind you that I believe it was episode 4. We already did stats about gun control, tried to look at both sides of the argument. What I came up with was both sides, you know, a reasonable person can take either side of the gun control argument. And I really think there are good stats and studies from either side where a reasonable person could come up either way. What I've also seen is what always happens when this happens is people decide that if you come out against gun control, you don't care about the victims. You don't care about the victims. Before we get into this a little bit, I want to say there's a difference between not caring about the victims and not thinking that the legislation that you're pushing would actually have the effect you want or should be done. There's a big difference there. Conservatives, a lot of people make fun of them because they send, you know, thoughts and prayers or whatever to the family. They say, well, that doesn't help them. And, you know, again, whether or not you believe in that or not, that's the best thing they can do. And they're really the only thing they can do, other than if they really do believe that gun control isn't necessarily the answer. I'll remind you that in our previous episode 4, we went through and looked at the stats, and we found that there are lots of studies that show that there are at least equal amounts of defensive use of firearms to homicides. We separated out the suicide stats from there, but there are at least as many defensive uses, if not more, depending on the source you looked at. Again, that number is very, very hard to actually come to a real one because it's hard to say how many lives were saved for instance, in the one church shooting where an individual with a firearm did stop it, how many people would have died if he wasn't there? You can't say that. And a lot of that's done by surveys, which have issues. And we'll actually get into that a little bit later as we go on, when we move on to the fact checker part. So with that, I did want to take a look at some of the facts. Again, just because something is lower doesn't necessarily mean that it shouldn't be addressed. But here, as we're looking, these are the gun deaths taken directly from, here's 2015 to 2019, taken from, I believe it's the FBI here. And you'll see what they have in 2019 is fewer than 400 rifle deaths, which, of course, that includes all rifles. And then when you talk about handguns, I believe that says 6,000. I apologize, it's a little bit 6,300. So you'll see it's a small portion in this case that was rifles. I do want to be very upfront and clear with people. You'll see that down below there's other guns. There's other guns, and then firearm type not stated. Is fairly large. The stats on this, unfortunately, aren't very good. A lot of this information either doesn't make it to the FBI or they have to glean from articles and different things. I will say, if they are gleaning it from articles, which is one of the things I read, I haven't seen a whole lot where they hide the fact or don't say the fact when it's an AR-style rifle. But you can see here that the vast majority of the documented ones are with handguns, and you'll see that's bared out in the research over and over and over again. You see that handguns are the ones by far with the homicides, and if you go and look as well, I'll also show you that this article just came out not that long ago. This one, I believe, was in Newsweek. It says, of the last 80 mass shootings in the United States, more than a quarter, including Monday's shooting in Boulder, Colorado, involved the use of an AR-15. So they use this as a more than a quarter. I believe the actual number is 26% of them used an AR-15. One thing that I briefly mentioned but went over is the definition of a mass shooting is not well defined. Be careful when you see different conversations, different stats. It's often defined in different ways depending on the organization. Even the FBI doesn't have a great definition. Most of the time it's, I believe, some say greater than three being killed. Some people just say it's greater than so many people being shot. It's all over the place. When you look at research, always look at that. Most of them include gang violence. Some of them take gang violence out. So it really just depends. But here you're looking over the last 80, just barely over a quarter used an AR. So that's one thing that you don't often see. You often see that the AR is the assault, or it's the assault rifle. Again, I'm aware that AR doesn't stand for assault rifle, but the ARs are the weapon of mass shooters. Okay, well, over the last 80, only a quarter of them used it. There are some stats out there that do show that the mass shooters that used assault rifles do have a slightly higher casualty rate. And a slightly higher injury rate than the ones that used handguns. There's some criticism around that whole debate, because that doesn't necessarily mean if that person in that situation had a handgun, it'd be any different. And also, a lot of the people that are using the assault rifles are also taking handguns. And again, I'm using assault rifle. I'm very loosely defining that. All of the gun people here are going to hate me for using that term. It's not really a defined term, other than the biggest definition you often hear. It's a weapon with a selector, basically. So it goes to a semi-auto in three-round burst or whatever. A burst in full auto is really kind of the military definition of that. And then there really is no civilian definition. But many people equate that with the AR-style rifle, the AK-style rifle, the military-styled rifles with that. So anyway, using that, I wanted people to keep that in mind, that while people, you'll often see the news saying that it's the choice of mass shooters, it's actually used in about a little bit less than a quarter. Again, as you'll see, the one we talked about, it was a 9mm pistol, which is a fairly small caliber. The AR rifle was used in the other one. It had slightly greater casualties. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, that's not the be-all end-all, win the argument there. the big thing I'm hearing, of course, there's a big push right now to ban AR-15s, again, I should say. With that, I wanted to really kind of look at that fact because we didn't cover that a whole lot in our last topic. And you'll see here that, again, those rifle killings aren't very high. You're more likely, as it said, by quite a bit to die from falling down the stairs, although that's just disproportionately elderly people, and that's by no means equivalent. I believe if we go back to those, I may not have the stats here, go back to the gun deaths here, you also see that rifles, for what they have in 2019, is 364. Knives is 1,476, and this is only murder victims by weapon. So you'll see here you're much more likely to get murdered by a knife than by a firearm. Again, I want to acknowledge that there is a large portion of the firearms type not stated. So it's possible that number could be higher, but if that follows any of the other ratios of the reporting, it still would come in well under the firearm, or it would come under the knives and other cutting instruments. So when people talk about these ARs being so deadly, yeah, they have the capability, more of a capability than a knife, but as far as how many people they kill, knives kill a lot more. And you'll also see, again, you can be nearly as effective with a pistol. That is scientifically been shown. Again, I'll say the study that I saw had not quite a twice as high lethality rate when they looked at some of them. Some of them had less. You will look, the biggest arguments against banning ARs is that they're weapons of war. I'm going to go ahead and state that if you tell me that I want to ban this because it's a weapon of war, you better tell me something more than it's a weapon of war. So one time I went and I looked at an AR rifle. I don't currently own one. And, you know, someone's like, oh, that's scary. That's a scary rifle. And I ask them, well, why is it scary? Well, because that's what mass shooters use and because they're scary. And really, that's all that a lot of people know about the rifles. And again, we looked, it's less than a quarter of mass shooters are using those. And I said, well, why are they scary to you? And it's like, well, I again, mass shooters use them. I think they're powerful. And so you get into that. If you look into some of the stats, other things that you'll see is, you know, they cause a wound cavity that's so much greater than a handgun. There's a very popular article. Sorry, I didn't pull it up here, from a doctor that talks about the difference he sees when he had his few AR victims versus people shot with a handgun. If anyone that's familiar with firearms, they won't laugh at that, but they'll shrug that off because it's obvious. The damage any rifle can do is much, much higher than a pistol. Any rifle. Shotguns are the same thing. The faster and the higher the velocity, as well as the weight of the bullet, all play an impact. But when you talk about these ultra fast 3,000 round per second, 2,000 round per second rifle rounds, they definitely have a greater impact. But what people argue is these ARs are they're weapons of war, and they are the most powerful weapons ever. And so a lot of people that are familiar with guns laugh a little bit, because I know when I was in the military, we'd often make fun of, you know, how small the bullet is and how ineffective it was compared to the AK platform that a lot of people were using other places. And you'll notice if you're a hunter, very few people hunt with the AR platform unless they're hunting small game or feral pigs. That's a big problem in Texas, and the use of ARs is actually very common hunting them because they don't have the stopping power to be able to humanely and effectively put down an animal. So when you look at it and you see a lot of this hype around it about how this terrible, terrible this is and how it's just such a powerful weapon, anybody that knows anything about guns normally will say it's nothing compared to most hunting guns. It's really not even close. So I did find an article. I looked into this a little bit, of course, trying to quantify what most people that are familiar with weapons know. And of course, what you'll say is, you know, if I got a choice, if I have to get shot and it's between a pistol and a rifle, I'd definitely take the pistol any day. Now, if it's a rifle, what rifle shoots me? It's not going to be a hunting rifle. We'll put it that way. It'd probably be a little .22 rifle. But if it had to be something higher than that, it would likely, unfortunately, be a 223 or 556, which is the AR platform. But when you look in this, I did find this one article by E. Gregory Wallace. I actually think he's a lawyer out of one of the universities. It was a fairly good, it was a decent analysis. But what he did is he looked at a lot of these claims that were being made and kind of argued in the courts about how that assault weapons, again in quotes there, like the AR-15, are exceptionally lethal, far beyond non-banned firearms, that the rate of fire is virtually identical to non-banned semi-automatic handguns, rifles, and shotguns. Its accuracy is better than firearms, and all of these claims that are being made in courts when they're arguing to ban these. He took a look at this, and basically what he said is, what he found is its fire rate is really very similar to most other semi-automatic weapons. That's just one of the things it is, including handguns. It does fire faster than most hunting, bolt-action hunting rifles, but it's really very similar to other guns, even some that aren't on the military-style platforms. And again, he looked at it and, yeah, sure, it's got more stopping power than a handgun, but it's got less stopping power than the vast majority of other non-banned guns, including almost all hunting rifles, which, as we went over in a different in episode 4, most Americans support people's right to have firearms to hunt. He did go through and talk about how it wasn't actually well suited for things. It didn't go through tons of walls as most people thought. He dispelled that it creates this huge wound cavity. Again, he basically said, yeah, it's greater than a pistol, but it's under a lot of others. And basically criticized some of the other studies on that. So really the overall takeaway from that individual and that one that kind of pulled a bunch of other research together was they're really not all that they're cracked up to be, especially in the mass shooter scenario. Sure, they can be more effective than a pistol, but a lot of these claims that are being made are kind of extraordinary, and it's a lot of hype and fear-mongering. Again, they're no different functionally than most hunting rifles. They're just smaller calibers, and may or may not be semi-automatic, which again just means one pull of the trigger equals one bullet. So with that, again, one thing I did want to acknowledge with him is I did find other articles from him that all seem to be anti-gun. I definitely believe he is pro-gun and against gun control. So he definitely was probably a biased author, I would say. So I'll acknowledge that. But again, I would encourage you, if you're not familiar with firearms, to kind of look into a little bit, talk to somebody that is, learn a little bit more about the platform, and I think it'll become a lot less scary to you. And I wouldn't believe any of those politicians that are telling you they're heavier than 10 moving boxes, or that they kick like a mule, or that necessarily that they're, you know, the most destructive thing as a cannon, or anything like that. That one, actually, I don't think was said. The moving boxes one was, and I've heard of another one, I forget who it was. It was a reporter, someone saying they got PTSD from firing one or something. They're really not that terribly powerful when compared to other rifles. I'm not necessarily arguing for or against currently banning them. What I am saying is they're not as deadly as most people think. They're not used as widely as most people think. They're not responsible for even close to the majority of deaths. And I really wanted to put that in context. And so really what we're talking about is removing one of the most popular rifles in America that is not causing that many deaths at all. And really what you're seeing is just small isolated incidents that are shocking. And I would discourage people from using fear from a few and isolated incidents that are shocking to set policy on all of Americans. Because again, it may or may not even have the effect that you want. We saw one of the shooters had a handgun. Other shooters have shown time and time again that other weapons can be used and will be used just nearly as effectively. So again, not necessarily arguing one way or another specifically on banning them or not. If you want my opinion, I don't think they should be banned. I don't own one currently. One day I might. They're great for target shooting. They're a lot cheaper than shooting my hunting rifle. They're fun to shoot. For those that don't know, they're fairly flat shooting, meaning, you know, you don't have to aim super high to go far, but they're not great for hunting, and to be honest, I probably wouldn't use one for home defense. That's not saying that somebody else might not. So moving on with that, if I miss something or if somebody wants to point out a source or statistics, feel free to leave a comment on YouTube or hit us up at dialoguenotdivision@gmail.com. I'm more than happy to have this conversation. Most likely we're going to have many gun control conversations over the next few years with that. So one of the things I did want to move into just real briefly is the whole kids in cages again, or the lack of calling it kids in cages, I should say, because what's going on right now is there are, I would say, nearly unprecedented surges to the border right now of people trying to come in. There are many, many unaccompanied minors trying to come in. Right now, the Biden administration refuses to call it a crisis. They don't want to put labels on stuff, but it is definitely unprecedented numbers coming, trying to come in. Facilities are booked at a max. And again, we're seeing Biden reopened many of those same facilities, or very similar facilities that were the kids in cages facilities that they called under Trump. He was highly scrutinized for them. This came up in the debates. It called it inhumane, human rights violations, all kinds of stuff. He was just absolutely lambasted for his use of these. Biden reopened them. And to me, what's worse isn't necessarily that he reopened them out of maybe desperation from all the people coming in. It's that what we're seeing from the current administration, and I think both sides are really catching up on this right now, is that the administration refuses to put a label on it, which, okay, fine. They are right now, other than releasing some numbers, they're refusing to let reporters in. They're not showing images of what's going on. They're not answering questions transparently, other than they say we're committed to being transparent, and then they're not transparent. So I'm just seeing so much of this lack of transparency around it. We did have one or two groups come with and try to find images of what was going on in these, because again, they were asking for images. They were asking for reporters to go in. All of these places were being told, don't talk to reporters, don't talk to even lawyers. They weren't even letting lawyers in for the immigrants detained in there. Basically, they didn't want anybody to see, weren't releasing any information. And we did have some images. This is one that I found. There was others from another group. And here's what you're seeing is stuff like this is happening. If for those that can't see, there's a very, very tight space. Looks like plastic sheeting in between it. There are many, many people in there on small cots and with the kind of aluminum blankets, those real thin, I believe it's called Mylar blankets. They're kind of used to highlight them. They're very packed in, close together. That image also is not the only one. I saw other ones that looked much, much worse. It absolutely looks terrible on the inside, and they're refusing to call it a crisis. And the biggest thing that I'm seeing is the media absolutely went after Trump for this. Absolutely went after Trump for this. The media here didn't pick up on it for a while, and now all they're talking about, or most of what I'm seeing other than Fox News, is I'm seeing them going, well, yeah, it's coming, but they're trying as hard as they can. The Biden administration is trying as hard as they can to get people out of there. I'm like, if this was Trump, and you would not be making excuses or saying he's trying as hard as he can. And just the hypocrisy that I'm seeing in the media right now makes me want to bring this up because, again, lack of transparency. They're supposed to. They're committed to transparency, but they're not giving transparency. And then the media is, especially for a while, was really downplaying this. More and more right now, they're picking up on it now that some of these pictures are coming out. But you don't see any images of AOC over there crying, crying for a photo opportunity, which was done under Trump. So, and I'm seeing a lot of some of the left-wing people not covering this. I guarantee you, if this was Trump, this would all be coming again. And I'm not saying that all I'm asking for is for the media to do their job and hold the government accountable. And I'm also asking for the transparency that the Biden administration promised and is not giving us. If you're going to say that, live up to it. Because the American people have a right to know what's going on. And then you got Biden saying things like he never told people to come here and, you know, it wasn't him, when you can clearly see in his debates that he was saying America should be the place where it's inviting these people in. And, you know, he wants people to come. And then there's interviews right now with the migrants, some that came in there, even like, yeah, pretty much I came here because of Biden, pretty much. You know, they don't know his specific policies, but they're pretty much admitting it. And they won't just say, hey, we some of our policies may have contributed to this, and we're working on it. Here's what it looks like. Here's what we're doing to fix it. Instead, it's we're working really hard. We're trying to meet CDC guidelines, and yet you see pictures of them squished together, which, again, these pictures look exactly like what was under Trump. And then you see a lot of the media making excuses for him. So if you don't know about that, I would encourage you to just, again, hold everyone accountable for what they're doing, regardless if it's your side of the aisle or not. So moving on to that topic, there's another thing that came across my mind, and I've talked about this before, and with it, it's really about the way this fact-checking system works. So for most of you that are on Facebook, which is probably the majority of you, Facebook and many other places, they use fact-checking organizations. It's a new thing to combat misinformation. So what they want to do is basically not allow people to spread things that are wrong. And what they do is they employ these independent fact-checkers. And if you share something that's misleading, partly false or false, it'll label it, and depending on what level it is, they may or may not make you click through something to even see the video. And of course, this is done to prevent the spread of misinformation or, you know, bad information that's influencing people. It might sound like a good idea on the, you know, on the face of things. What I want to say, though, is there's been a lot of questions about them. I've seen a lot of the way they word things. It almost seems like they tweak with the version of things they're fact-checking so that they can turn it away from false to, you know, to partly true or mostly true or things like that. And I've seen a lot of that, and some of it's kind of felt it's all anecdotal, but, you know, and it's felt like, is this my biases working? So I wanted to look into it just a little bit. But what really triggered this for me is this gun rights activist, Kolion Noir, I believe I'm saying that correctly. He did a response, a video response to a tweet that said 90% of Americans support universal background checks. So he did a video YouTube on this, and for some reason, basically he said, again, he was arguing that they don't support it. And the PolitiFact, I believe it was, fact-checked him as false, and then made it so that people had to click through stuff if it was shared on Facebook. So again, I'm not going to get further into whether or not, I'm not going to get super far into any of the more gun control stuff, but I really wanted to talk about how this one was handled, because he did a follow-up video that talked exactly about how this process worked, and a bunch of the things. So I'm going to kind of sum that up here of what he said. I highly recommend you check out that video that I just showed. Here I'll actually, I'll say the title of it. So it's Kolion Noir. Proof Facebook fact checkers are censoring debates on constitutional rights like the Second Amendment is the title of his video. If you want to go look it up, I do highly recommend that you take a peek at his, because he walks it through a lot more of than I will here. But so basically, here's what happened is a politician tweeted out, and he said, you know, that universal background checks are bipartisan support and widely supported. 90% of Americans support universal background checks, and tweeted that out. So he did a video on it. His video was decent, I would say. It was I actually felt like it wasn't the most convincing video he's ever done, which is interesting because their fact check, I'll get to that later, but made him do a much better video. But really, his argument against there was the polls were misleading, which, again, we talked about that. A lot of times gun control, pro-gun control stuff comes from polls, and they argue they're misleading, and which is most polls, is if you, depending on how you ask the question, can influence the answer. And one of his main criticisms was the poll that they were referring to does not specifically ask about universal background checks. It just says background checks. Do you support background checks? In case you're not a gun person, right now it's federally mandated that you go through a NICS background check if you buy a weapon from any dealer. Right now, you do not have to do a background. In some states, you don't have to do a background check if it's a private person-to-person sale. However, if you're an individual that's selling firearms frequently, you have to register as basically a gun company and do it. So it's not like something that, oh, you know, you can just go pick up and resell weapons all the time and get around it is the intention of the law. I'm not saying that it's always enforced that way, but that's the intention of the law. So that's what's currently in the system. The vast majority of Americans support background checks similar to that. Now, when you say universal background checks, that means different things to different people. And this was his argument, is that when you specifically ask universal background checks, that number goes down significantly. And then when you start explaining what it takes to enforce a universal background check, namely gun registration, to actually enforce that, because I guess I should back up a little bit here. Normally speaking, universal background checks means that you want background checks for absolutely every transfer of a firearm ever. So including, depending on what you say, normally it's paired with basically if I sell it to my brother, then I have to do one. So if I, in some places, I think the one currently going through, the way it's worded is so vague that, you know, if I hand it over to, if I even loan my weapon to somebody else at the range, I could be in trouble for it because it wasn't registered to them. So even loaning a weapon, when you loan it back, you'd have to get a background check. When you loan it to them, you'd officially transfer it to them. And then you'd have to, when they were done with it, officially transfer it back. Which, keep in mind, right now it is illegal to knowingly give a felon a firearm, or anybody that's not allowed to own one. So you do have to have that kind of, if you know that they're not allowed to, or that they're likely not allowed to, that is illegal. That what they're trying to do is say you have to enforce that. And then they talk about closing other loopholes that may or may not exist. We'll leave it there. So really what they're saying is every single background check has to, or every single transfer has to be documented, and it has to be done. The whole thing he argued was not everyone is in favor of that, especially when you talk about loaning a weapon to somebody, different things like that. And again, when you go into how you enforce that, it's hard to enforce knowing if a firearm was transferred to somebody under the current system without enacting registration, meaning the federal government would need to know that the gun was mine. And then they have to know that the gun was somebody else's. So you'd have to register it with the federal government. And many, many pro-gun rights people don't like the idea of registration, because registration, from what they would argue, comes before confiscation. Because the only reason why they want to know what guns you have is so that they can take them in the future. I'm not going to debate that right now. Feel free to debate that with your friendly gun activist. I should say pro-gun rights activist. But so that's kind of the argument there. Really, it starts coming into a lot of that registration, strict rules, different things like that. There's one case where that I saw, I don't have it pulled up now, but where somebody got in trouble for transferring a firearm in one of the states that does have a similar rule to this, not federal, because he left his firearm in the glove compartment, and then I believe it was his girlfriend or something drove the vehicle. So he was in serious trouble with the law because of that. It was inadvertent. There's other stories you hear all the time where when these get really strict, people accidentally break these laws, but I digress. Back to the point here is when you start nailing down the specifics of that, what he's arguing is that support goes down. First, you have to ask the question right in the first place, meaning if you're going to say 90% of Americans support universal background checks, the question on the survey needs to be, do you support universal background checks? Not do you support background checks in some form or different things like that. Words have meaning. In this case, universal background checks has a very specific meaning. So that was his biggest complaint. And then he cited a little bit of evidence, not a ton, that he went into that. So really that's kind of what he summed up and said, hey, you can't necessarily make that claim. And the more you look into it, or the more people understood what was required, the less that support's going to go down. So no, it's not as high as you'd think. So that's what he released that. And then he got contacted by, I believe it was a PolitiFact fact checker. I'm going to put that in quotes because I really don't like what happened here. So they sent an email, said, hey, we're investigating your post on this claim They gave him less than 4 hours to respond and said, if you have any other evidence that you'd like us to consider, you have to respond within 4 hours. I don't know about you, but if you ask me that, I think that's unreasonable. People have other things to do than, you know, to dig up a bunch of facts within in under 4 hours to get back to you. They may not even check their email for all they know. Who knows? Maybe he's on vacation that day. One of his big complaints with that is, it's like, give me at least 12 hours, 24 hours, something like that, if you really want to know. And then I believe it was like 30, 40 minutes after that under 4 hour time frame passed, the article posted. So again, it's not like they saved time to write the article with if he did send back facts. So his argument there is, you know, they reached out just so they can say they reached out and then I didn't respond. Didn't give me any real time to respond. So, okay, that's bad, but all right. So then he looked up the individual that was fact-checking his tweet, and so the individual has many, many anti-gun tweets and has written articles, anti-gun articles. So it's not exactly some neutral person. It's definitely somebody that has an agenda, which I don't know about you, but if it went the other way, let's say if you were a liberal, I think one of the articles used the example of a climate change person. Some conservatives don't believe climate change. How would you feel if somebody that was very against the idea of climate change was fact-checking your climate change claim? You would have questions on whether or not they could be objective about that. So again, already you're seeing somebody that already has an agenda is working on this. And so with that, he further looked on, and he released this article, and basically what he did is, in it, of course, he said that he reached out to him and he didn't respond. It had inaccurate information, not necessarily the be-all end-all, but it had inaccurate information. So this individual, I believe like 3-4 years ago, was an NRA host of a show, and it claimed he was still an NRA host. So it was like falsely tying him to the NRA. So if he said former, great, but he didn't. So it's like, okay, so there's a factual inaccuracy in the in his fact check, which I would expect my fact checkers to have their facts straight. So that kind of bothered him. And then in the article, one of the big things he did is he basically argued against his position by saying he didn't offer evidence that it's not true, so it's not true, which is interesting. So basically, because you didn't prove that it wasn't true, what you said is untrue, was kind of what it went down to. He offered a little bit more, though, I'll go into later. And then in the article, the Kalyan Noor, he goes by an alias. He doesn't release his real name. He released his real name in the article, for which to me makes no sense, which of course that to him, he's like, yeah, okay, you can get it, but why are you releasing my real name? It has no bearing on this other than to try to shame me. In that article, it also misquoted him. It linked to one of his widely misquoted articles, and he showed exactly what it said. It's a comment taken out of context quite blatantly that makes him look bad. He showed the full context of the clip. It's nothing like it. So in this, again, it's the article, the fact-checking article wasn't about the fact. It was what he called a hit piece on him, which when you start talking about you're revealing his real name, you're trying to make him look bad and discredit him. I'm starting to agree with that there. And then he said that requiring a registry, that Colin said, you know, if people knew that enforcing that would require a registry, that was false because he didn't provide evidence. And so, which of course he's done videos in the past on why that's important. He also, in his new video, he showed how the U.S. Justice Department said that. They said that to effectively enforce it, they would require a registry. So basically what he's saying is, this guy didn't even go and look that up or do any research on that, and just said, because I didn't have enough facts in my post, that's false, because he didn't agree with it. And then as far as the he didn't really evaluate the claim that none of them said universal background checks or use the word universal in there. And all he said is, the best evidence we have to date is that 90% of the people do. And he cited 12, I think it was 12 or 10, 10 surveys. I believe all under was less than 2,000 people, and not a single one of them, according to Kalyan, used the word universal. So again, the only evidence he used didn't use the word universal. So again, it's the you can't disprove it, so what you said is false, is basically how this was working. And so what's funny to me is, so they came out, he basically did a hit piece on him, said what he said was false, doing no research, it wasn't very objective, by a person that he could verify wasn't objective on the fact. And it's funny because he did this new video, and part of it is he actually provided even more evidence, a much more convincing argument to me, because he actually went through and showed how there were other polls with a larger amount of people where that number drastically went down once you specifically mentioned universal background checks. He also brought up the fact that this has been voted on in, I believe, 5 blue states. And he took all of the votes or the percentages on how many people. There's been over 4 million votes on this for actual policy for universal background check. And I think it was barely above 50% supported or voted yes on this, with everyone else voting no. So what he's saying is, here is 4 million people that have voted for or against this. And out of that, there's nowhere near 90% support this, which to me is much better than a bunch of surveys that don't even ask the question that actually back up the statement of universal background checks. So again, I'm not trying to argue the universal background checks topic. What I'm trying to say here is, this was a great example of how messed up the fact-checking system is. This right here is a guy that obviously was biased. And that's one of the things that when I looked up the different things, is they talked about how you would assume that these people are unbiased. So I believe it was this article here by Forbes, said the Daily Mail Snopes story and fact-checking the fact-checkers. So basically there was a Daily Mail story that said fact-checkers, they don't follow this, they do this wrong, blah, 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 this and that. So this guy goes and says, well, obviously this is just a hit piece. Fact-checkers are here to fact-check. Of course they're going to do this. He acknowledges that he started off from this as saying, of course the fact-checkers are fine. They're just trying to place doubt on the fact-checkers. That way, you know, it causes the misinformation, you know, confusion and all of that. So he started off with that point, and he goes to one of the fact checkers and he asks them for some basic details about how it works. And basically the article is talking about his frustration and how that he couldn't get any answers for how fact checking works. He asked about, like, what's your vetting process, or how do you make sure these people can fairly evaluate it? Well, basically they couldn't tell him that. They couldn't tell him any of the details, so it was all secret. Now this is a little bit older, but his whole thing is here, if you can't even tell me how you're hiring or how this fact checking process works, how can I have faith in the system? That's transparency is important for me to have faith in that. So he talked about this, and then so again, I looked some more into this, and I found a study that was done by, I believe it was RNP. It had a lot of statistics in it and stuff like this. It's a 2018 study, but this is the conclusion they came up with. In the context of political claims and statements, I have examined two of the main factors which fact-checkers suggest make fact-checking powerful: a large overlap and high consensus rate among major fact-checkers. My findings suggest that fact-checkers rarely fact-check the same statement, and when they do, the rate of agreement on its factual accuracy is quite low for statements in the relatively ambiguous scoring range, like half true or mostly false. Relative to outright falsehoods or obvious truths, these statements are likely to be carefully crafted, subtle forms of deceptive remarks. This is where fact-checking has the most to offer the public, but this is the scoring range in which they struggle the most. The surprisingly low rate at which different fact-checkers agreed when evaluating the same statements in this scoring range suggests that providing objective information about candidates' honesty is quite difficult. So this was a study done. They looked at a bunch of the different fact-checkers, and basically what they said is, I can't have confidence in this. It's not doing what it's saying it's doing. They're not evaluating the same statements. Even when they do, they don't agree. There's a lot that's being done. So moving on, there was another one. Another article I was looking at. This one's in, I believe, the Investor's website. This one, they had issues again with the fact-checking system. Fact-checkers also often check opinions rather than factual claims. We'll look into that in a minute. Even though two people can form diametrically opposed opinions based on the same facts. And then worse, many media fact checks use other media sources to check facts, apparently forgetting that journalists get their facts wrong almost as often as politicians. So the first statement they make there is they're often evaluating opinions rather than facts. So obviously you can only fact check facts. Something's either true or it's not. Again, opinions are something you come to generally by looking at facts or by collecting different information. You come to your opinion. An example of this is, it was actually kind of, I remember a fact check that came out. It was kind of a mix between an opinion and a fact. One of the fact checks they did is on one of the stories was back quite a while ago after the Capitol riots, AOC had a big story that was going on about how basically she implied, didn't actually say she was there in the Capitol, and that people were coming for her, and it was this big scary story. And it turned out, it came out, she wasn't in the Capitol building at the time. She was in the Capitol complex. The complex is a big series of buildings. The building was a decent way further away. They did evacuate her building, but it basically, what came out to it is, it was this, it kind of made AOC look bad. And so the fact checkers fact check a statement that say AOC wasn't even in the Capitol building, which again, she wasn't in the building. She was in the complex, but not the main building. And what they said is they called it mostly false. But what they actually fact checked was two things in that article. They fact check whether or not she was in the building, as well as whether or not she overreacted. So because that was both the claims. Again, they crafted the claim they were fact checking so that they could come up with a narrative. And so they admit in there that she wasn't in the actual Capitol building. That's not where she was. And then they go on and say it's false that she exaggerated the danger she was in. And if you go and you look at it, the danger she was in, different people could absolutely come up with different things. One of her fellow colleagues also talked about how, you know, she was calm, but AOC was not. So it just, different people that have been through different things handle fear in different situations differently. That's an opinion. Whether or not somebody overreacted to a situation is an opinion. You can't fact check that. There's no way to fact check whether or not somebody overreacted, especially if it's an edge case or not. So that's an example of where they fact checked an opinion also tied to a fact. But because they did that, they got to call it mostly false or mixed, and, you know, get that label added to the story. So kind of to suppress that information, because again, now people are looking, well, it's mostly false or it's mixed. So, you know, a lot of people aren't going to read it. I know I may or may not. A lot of times I'll read the article, though. So that's one of them. This is another interesting one. Same article in Investors. Again, it says, so they also use fact checkers to fact check to decide. Basically, the other fact checkers use fact checkers to see if they're right on their articles. So the problem is that fact checkers themselves can be unreliable sources for what's true or not. Fact checkers may make their own mistakes. They sometimes change ratings based on new information, or they make determinations based on arbitrary standards they can change from one review to the next. Case in point, PolitiFact called a 2012 Mitt Romney campaign ad its lie of the year for a statement about Jeeps being made in China. And then PolitiFact admitted that the lie in the ad was actually the literal truth. So I want you to think about that for a minute. They actually called it and dubbed it their lie of the year. Their lie of the year. And then it turned out it was actually the truth. And the thing that happens there, the thing that's concerned is, sure, they made a mistake, they corrected it, but they make a mistake, things get, you know, it makes, in this case, Mitt Romney look bad for a while. Things can't get shared. It interferes with the flow of information. People remember that, and then you change it later, and, you know, a few people see it, but not everyone sees it. And here, that's a blatant example of them getting it wrong, was one of their examples. Here's another one that I brought up looking at fact checker. So this organization, now I forget what it is, Real Fair Politics, I believe is what it's called. They went through and they now have a site where they kind of fact check the fact checkers. And here you'll note, I looked up on their site, how many basically use a source of a university or academic type, and of their different fact checking sites. And you'll notice here in this chart, if you can see it, the top one, the one that uses the most university sources only use university sources or actually academic research to back up their fact checking 34% of the time. And that's PolitiFact. 34. So about a third, a little over a third of the time they're actually using credible sources. Wow, that's interesting. Fact check goes to 25. New York Times is only 15%. Washington Post is 15%. Snopes is only 11%. Weekly Standard is only 7% using academic sources. So what they're really highlighting there, or what this is highlighting, is what sources are they using? So let's take a quick peek at that. If you're looking here, this may be hard to read, but PolitiFact, they have some stats here. Basically, they have a bunch of checks. So the sources for their verdict was 9% of their sources were from themselves, PolitiFact. So they sourced their own. 3% was from the New York Times. 3% was from the Washington Post. This is a specific topic here. 3% was the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or not specific topic. These are the major places they're sourcing. And 1% was from the Associated Press. So I want you to think about that. Those are the major sources they're using. Themselves is their top source. The second one is the New York Times, which I don't believe is the most neutral. As well as the Washington Post, which again is also, I don't believe, a neutral organization, Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Okay, I get that. That's an actual scientific body. And then 1% was the Associated Press, which I do believe is fairly, it's ranked in the middle. If you go to Snopes, 9%, again, their highest source for their verdict is themselves, Snopes. And then they go to New York Times, Washington Post, Associated Press, and CNN. Those are their top sources where they're getting their information to claim things are either true or false. And this goes down through the list. Washington Post, 12% of theirs comes from the Washington Post. What a surprise. New York Times, 15% comes from the New York Times. And then their next lowest is Washington Post. And then they're going to Center for Disease Control, factcheck.org. So yet another one. So again, what I'm seeing here is they're using other news sites, exactly what the article said, to fact check, and their primary focus, or their biggest one, is themselves. So they're fact checking themselves, their own organization, and they're not even using their largest ones aren't credible organization. They're not academic research, and yet they're doing fact checks, and that's the facts they're pulling from. Now I get it. Some things you kind of have to pull together and do that. They're trying to operate fast, but this is what's deciding whether or not people can share things. So let's go down. One of the other things they said is it's often opinion that they're fact-checking. So I pulled this up here. Again, that same site. It evaluates whether or not they felt like the claim was opinion or a verifiable fact. The Washington Post, 15% of what they looked at in their over the last, I think it's 1,249 days, 15% of what they fact-checked was opinion. New York Times, 15% of what they fact-checked was opinion. And then it goes down from there, factcheck.org, 7%, PolitiFact is 7%, Weekly Standard, 2%, and Snopes was a lot less at 1%. But what you're seeing in here is, again, there's a high activity of fact-checking opinion. Fact-checking opinion. How do you fact-check an opinion? You can't. It's an opinion. Now you can fact check specific claims, but you can't fact check an opinion. And you're seeing here the top ones doing 15% of what they're fact checking is really what it comes down to in is opinion. And that's one of the big things there. I wanted to show another example since we have one. This one also happens to be a gun example because I clicked one. Here's one that Senator Rubio said his red flag bill would not allow gun confiscation with. It says no, his red flag bill would not allow gun confiscation without due process. So red flag laws, if you're not familiar, basically it says you say, hey, so-and-so that I know or I'm close to, I think they're a danger to themselves or others. You need to take away their guns. Normally you go to law enforcement, I believe, you file that complaint, a judge decides, they take away the gun. So here's what they said here. If your time's short, here's the summary. A court order could could order the temporary confiscations of guns on an emergency basis if a judge is a threat to himself or others. The person would not have a right to attend that hearing, but sworn testimony by law enforcement or members of the person's family or household will be presented. A person whose guns are temporarily confiscated would have a right to be present at another court hearing to be held within 14 days. And they ruled this as, I believe, mostly false or false. I have the thing here. So, again, here's what they're saying is, no, it would not violate due process. So they're stating this fact. So I looked, what does due process mean? So one of the things they acknowledge in here is, well, due process is a little vague. Okay, good. Due process is a little vague. So I Googled due process. What does it mean to most people? Here's one site I pulled up. Due process is basically a legal requirement that no citizen be deprived of their legal rights without proper application of the law. In other words, under due process, a person cannot have their property seized or to be put in jail without first going to the legal system to determine if they are guilty of the crime or they've been accused of. And it goes on from there. So they can't have their property seized without going through the system and them being determined guilty. That's exactly what a red flag law is. If you do this definition, you definitely get your property confiscated before you're determined guilty. Now, you might argue that that's not a great definition. That didn't come from, I don't think it came from like a major legal site or anything else. I looked up another one. This is also due process, procedural due process. Again, procedural due process is a concept that requires that a person be given notice and a chance to be heard when the state is taking action to deny them life, liberty, or property. Let me remind you what a red flag law is. You lose your property without ever knowing because somebody else claimed that something happened. So I think now you might be able to argue due process by other definitions just mean that there's a process of law and it's fair and equally applied. There is also that definition. And again, the article acknowledges that the definition can be a little bit shaky. Well, here, if you look at that definition, the red flag law absolutely violates the one of where you need to be notified and present or found guilty, depending on which definition you lose, before your property is taken away. In this case, what happens, and they cite the actual law, is either a police officer or a close family member comes in. They say, hey, this person's an issue. They give a sworn statement, which nobody ever falsifies those, correct? you might remember that during this election period, there were quite a few sworn statements of malfeasance in the system. And again, we're reassured that this is the most secure election system ever. But again, there were sworn statements, lots of them. But so a sworn statement, or either you or a family member or a police officer come in, they swear some things, and the judge decides if there's a, you know, if it's reasonable. I believe there's actually a higher standard for this one. But a judge decides, hey, yeah, it's good, and then the police come and take your weapons. I don't know how this specific bill has it enforced, but many of the fear is it's going to be How do you think the police are going to come to take a weapon from somebody that they believe is mentally unstable? And the answer is most likely with SWAT. They're going to bust in your door and take your weapon. Now, maybe that's over the top. Maybe that's wrong. I don't know. I'm not going to present that as fact, so don't fact check me on that one. But that's the thing there is, again, you don't even know this is happening. This happens without your consent, or not, well, without you even knowing, without you getting a chance to come there and defend yourself, and then you get your property taken away. So if you go by two of the definitions that I looked up of due process, you could absolutely see that, yes, it, by those definitions, you might be considering, it might be considered a violation of due process. You could also argue, and I'm sure many, many legal scholars would, that no, this doesn't, because there is a process. Yes, of course, you could come back after, you know, and argue for it, but still, it's taken away before they take away your property, before you even have a chance, before you know. And that's the big thing. That's kind of my catch with red flag laws. I'm kind of on the fence with many of them, because obviously they serve a purpose, and used appropriately and sparingly, perhaps they could likely save lives. But if misused, they could also be terrible, especially because we're talking about potentially spouses and other things that may, or ex-spouses, under that law, ex-spouses or anybody that lived around the individual, I think within the last year could do it, could absolutely do something like that. And I'll remind you that swatting is a thing, people calling the police on other people they don't like so that and telling them things like this so that they bust in their door and do things like this, which is a very dangerous situation. It is, there is a precedent of things similar to this being misused. I believe a couple states already have this. I don't think there's been a high occurrence of this either being used or it being misused currently. So there's an argument for and against. But really what I'm trying to argue here is that a reasonable person could see, yes, absolutely, this is a violation of due process, because due process means I get to go and talk to the judge as well. I know that this is happening. I can defend myself. And here's the result they said. So the statement contains an element of truth, but ignores critical facts that would give a different impression. Our definition of mostly false. So again, mostly false, slap something on Facebook saying it's mostly false. And I hope that I've convinced you that at least you can see how there could be a valid concern that somebody is getting violating their due process. Again, I'm not making the argument that 100% is, but what I'm saying is a reasonable person could see that. And yet we have somebody that said, nope, that's false, or mostly false. And you get that thrown up and trying to control the conversation. So that's another example. One of the great takeaways from that investor's article I saw is, it says, really kind of sums the article up, is there's a bigger problem with this fact-checking trend, however. As the Weekly's Standard Mark Hemingway explained, it's basically a way for a bunch of reporters with no particular expertise to render pseudoscientific judgments on statements from public figures that are obviously argumentative or otherwise unverifiable. Then there's the matter of them weighing in with thundering certitude. For instance, one of them is pants on fire. They call them liar pants on fire. On complex policy debates, they frequently misunderstand. So what they're saying is there's this big problem. We're giving people the random journalists, the ability to weigh in on very complex issues, multifaceted issues, and basically just weigh in, and then it looks scientific, pseudoscientific. So we're just giving these random people this power, and in this case, controlling the flow of information, or limiting the flow of information, I should say, especially on Facebook, because now people are looking at your post and saying, oh, that's mostly false. And then they go on to say the best thing that about this, and the takeaway that I want you to get from them. From this, in the end, the best way to judge the veracity of claims being tossed around is to become better informed about the issues, not contract out the job to people who aren't necessarily qualified to do it for you. And I really think that's the biggest takeaway that I want you to get, is the fact checkers often get it right, I feel like. But sometimes I feel like they have an agenda, and sometimes I think they manipulate it. And the best thing you can do is use them as a starting point, but also take it with a grain of salt and investigate issues yourself. Don't contract it out to people that in the end, they're really just journalists. They're just journalists, and journalists have biases. Journalists make mistakes. They're often not even sourcing academic research. They're using their own work, other people's work, to back up these claims. So take a look at it. And this is one of the biggest things. That's actually a big reason why I started this podcast, is because I saw so much of this going on, and people not giving other people a fair shake, and then you get these pseudo-scientific fact checks going on that I really felt like were biased, and yet you really dig into issues, and I really feel like you have to dig into many of these issues, but not everyone has time to dig into the issues. So what I want to do is dig into a couple, show some facts from both sides, hopefully open people's mind to see at least a reasonable person could think both ways, and close it from there. But really what I'm saying is you have to spend a little time when you see an outrageous claim or a claim you don't think is right, spend a little bit of time digging into it for yourself and try to purposely get the other side of the issue, especially if it's very contentious. So try to search out, if you're looking for gun rights, don't just search out why ARs are bad. Search out why ARs are good, or, you know, how many lives do guns save? Things like that. So search both sides. Oftentimes what I find is these extreme statements that make the mainstream media news are really, in context, not as bad as you think. And so go to the sites, especially if you hear, you know, so-and-so said this. Just go listen to the clip and see what context they said it into. As some people say, just expand that on both sides. For instance, that Colion Noir, I believe I'm saying his name right, misquote. Like, if you expand that, you could easily say, see what he was saying didn't mean what people were trying to say. And yet there's all these mainstream media or these journalist activists, what I feel like intentionally taking things out of context. And it's not just journalists. It's also people on these conservative and liberal shows that are intentionally, well, not necessarily intentionally taking things out of context, but they're reading things through the filter of their confirmation bias. And often they are taking it to mean things that it doesn't necessarily mean. And I see that quite frequently. So overall thing that I want you to take from this is fact checking is decent, but make sure you do it yourself. Don't contract it out to some random journalist, as they said. Take it with a grain of salt. Read the fact check. Go through it. See if it makes sense to you. Do a little bit of research. If you spend 5 or 10 minutes, you'll be better off in this world. So anyway, thank you very much for those of you that have made it this far. I hope you like this episode. Please do leave me a comment or shoot me an email at dialogue.notdivision. Let me know what you think. Let me know if there are any topics that you want me to cover, and I just may cover them in the next episode. So thank you very much, and have a great week.